Yesterday, Governor Pritzker presented his first budget address in Springfield before a joint session of the General Assembly. It's the beginning of the give and take between him and state lawmakers, and it should lead to a final budget by the end of May. Today, reaction from lawmakers on what they liked, what they didn't, and where there's room for some middle ground. Plus, we'll speak with photojournalist Chris Capozzello about his exhibition, The Distance Between Us. It tells the story of what it's like to have a twin with cerebral palsy.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll speak with photojournalist Chris Capozzello about his exhibition, The Distance Between Us. It documents his life with a twin sibling who has cerebral palsy. But first, yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker delivered his first budget address. Consider it a blueprint of sorts, a starting point for negotiations between him and state lawmakers. At the end of it all, we should have a final budget in place by May 31st. Yesterday, Governor Pritzker proposed a $38.7 billion budget. But he says that because Illinois is already in such a difficult financial situation, his budget doesn't have everything he wants.
To get to fiscal stability and eliminate our structural deficit, there's no quick fix. It took decades to get us into this mess. It will take at least several years to get us out of it.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. After his speech yesterday, we wanted to hear how people reacted, including the lawmakers who have to work with him to pass the budget. Representative Greg Harris is from Illinois' 13th House District, which includes parts of Chicago's North Side. He's a Democrat who became the new majority leader last month. And I started yesterday by asking him how the mood in the State House was different compared to last year.
I think it's interesting you ask that first, because the mood was just so strikingly different. There's a sense of optimism. There's been a real sense of collaborating and working together and understanding, like, after the last 4 years, the state is in a very, very bad position. And it's going to take a long time and a lot of hard work and a lot of tough decisions to straighten this out. But I think everyone sitting in that room, Republican, Democrat, Senate, governor's office, understand we got to work together and, you know, do a lot of compromising.
So let's talk about your new role as the House Majority Leader, where you think most likely are going to be the easiest places to work with everyone across the aisle as well as within the party. And let me just start by asking about the fair tax that Governor Pritzker has referred to. He called it a progressive income tax at one point. We haven't seen very many details of that, but I wonder how much you've heard from Governor Pritzker that intends to be a big part of this piece going forward.
Well, I think the governor made it clear that this is going to be one of the single most important focal points of his administration, of getting a fair tax to shift the burden from lower income and working families to the very wealthy. And this is not a new concept. This is how we pay our taxes to the federal government, that you are taxed based on your ability to pay, and those who, you know, are able to pay more of their fair share.
We also heard the governor say that he wanted to introduce a capital bill in this session. Have you heard details from him on that?
Well, I think everyone wants a capital bill, and this is you know, how legislating works and working across the aisle. On the spending side, you know, you have no problem finding folks who have ideas and want to be in the process, because everyone has roads in their area, bridges, schools, university buildings that need to be fixed and repaired. So spending the money is the easy part. Finding people to take the votes to find a revenue source and vote for it to fund all of this, that's where you're going to have to sit down and negotiate and, you know, really, you know, pull some people along to be a yes vote.
You were mentioned the speech, and I wanted to ask you in particular about the tax on insurance companies that would help cover the cost of state Medicaid.
A lot of other states are doing this already, and enables you to find a source that is not out of the income tax. It's not out of the sales tax. It's taxing some of the biggest corporations in America, insurance companies. And then those funds can be matched by the federal government and come back and be essentially double what they were when they left the state. And in Illinois, we do this in other industries already in healthcare. The hospital assessment is worth about $3.5 billion a year. And again, this is money that taxpayers do not have to pay. We do a similar assessment on the nursing home industry and on supportive living.
The governor also said that he feels that state programs that are not working should be cut. We didn't hear any specifics of that. I wonder if there nobody likes to everyone likes to talk about what they want to fund, and it's always tougher to talk about things that do not need funding. Are there things in particular you think that we could improve on in terms of efficiency?
Well, sure, and this is what the appropriation process is for in the House and the Senate in the hearings, where we'll have public hearings, providers, think tanks, experts, citizens, community leaders from across the state will come in and they'll talk about each individual program, each thing we spend money on, and their view of whether or not this is working, whether it could be improved, or whether it should be gotten rid of.
This is a starting document going forward. I wonder what your priorities are as House Majority Leader as we think about this upcoming session.
I think our priorities now, either in the House majority as Democrats, as Republicans, and I've been talking to my Republican colleagues about the last couple days about this, I think all of us right now want to be sure that we have a full and participatory budgeting process where all the members participate from both sides of the aisle. And over the last 4 years under Governor Rauner, that process fell apart because there were no budgets and he was not wanting to cooperate. It's a new day. We want the Republicans and Democrats to sit down in the regular process we go through and scrutinize every line in the budget and decide, should it go up, should it go down, is it something that we just no longer need to do anymore?
And you're confident that by May 31st that will happen?
In every other year except the last part. Illinois is 200 and some years old, and the only time in history that that has not happened was the last 4 years.
House Majority Leader Representative Greg Harris, Representative the 13th House District in Illinois. Thank you for taking the time to be with me.
Thanks for having me.
That's Representative Greg Harris. He became House Majority Leader last month. In this session, he and his fellow Democrats have more power than they've had in a long time. But there are still tough questions about our state's finances, no matter who's in power, like our pension system. Illinois owes $133.7 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. Governor Pritzker said he would address this in a few ways, including using money from a progressive income tax he'd like to pass. I spoke with Democratic Senate President John Cullerton from the state capitol yesterday, and I asked him what he thought of the governor's budget and his plan to address our pension problem.
Well, it's a very straightforward budget, unlike the budgets we heard in the last 4 years. I remember one of Governor Rauner's budget addresses, he just said, oh, by the way, we're going to save $2 billion by not paying $2 billion in pension costs on July 1st. And he didn't explain why or how. That was before the Supreme Court decision on pensions. But still, this governor knows what the Constitution says. He knows that he has some pressures. And he made a proposal which wasn't just 1 point. It was really 5 points. And so taken all together, I think it's very responsible.
And when we're thinking about your consideration model for pensions, how are you feeling about that these days in terms of that being a solution to the current problem?
Well, that actually passed the Senate. A lot of people don't know that. It was part of the grand bargain. It had 15 Democrats support out of, 37. It had 16 Republicans out of 22. And it wasn't called in the House. This governor did not, and unions were opposed to it. This governor did not run on it. He didn't say he was for it. It obviously didn't get called in the House by the Speaker. So it's out there. It saves about $1 billion a year. It's constitutional, in my opinion. But it looks like it's not going to be advanced. So as an alternative, the governor proposed what he proposed.
So you're not thinking of advancing that this year?
I can't pass it out of the House or get the governor to sign it, apparently. So it's just people should just be aware that it's out there.
When we're thinking about other specifics, I wonder if you felt like Governor Pritzker was honest enough today in his assessment of where we are at when we look at our spending priorities and our fiscal situation.
Well, yes, very, very responsible because it's a balanced budget. He tells you exactly what has to be added in revenue. He shows you how he's saving money in the pension changes that he's proposed. There's been additional revenues that have come in, higher than what we expected a few months ago. And I was going to cross-examine him if it wasn't balanced, because I've criticized Governor Rauner. I didn't want to just paper over his unbalanced budget, but it's not. It is balanced. And he tells you if we don't pass these things, we're going to cut, discretionary spending by 15%. That's true. That's what it amounts to.
What do you want taxpayers to take away from this, for people who are just the people who are tuning in and maybe are not paying attention to all of the day-to-day negotiations?
Two things. Your tax burdens are not going to increase. He flat out ruled out raising income taxes in the next 2 years. He also made it real clear he wants us to have a graduated income tax, which will result in lower taxes for overwhelming majority of Illinoisans and higher taxes for the wealthiest. That's very clear. And he made that clear. And he's going to propose it. We're going to work with him on that constitutional amendment, as well as a bill that would spell out what those tax rates are, so everybody knows what the deal is.
I wanted to ask you about that. Or do you have any specifics or any ideas on how that will come?
I do not. The governor, I asked him today about it. He said we're going to start working on it soon to decide what those brackets should be. But we have great evidence from all around us. Three-fourths of the states that have an income tax, which I think is something like 40 states, have a graduated income tax. If you look at Iowa, Nebraska, certainly Minnesota or Wisconsin, they all have much higher tax rates. In fact, even the people in Indianapolis are paying more in taxes than they are in Chicago right now. So a lot of people just don't know that. Everybody, from your own state, says, "Oh, we're the worst in the nation." Well, it's not true at all. We're the state level, the taxes are just unfairly assessed because of the flat tax.
If I'm recalling correctly, I don't recall the governor saying anything about taxing services. Is that something that you think will
be
on?
He said that would be one of the options you'd have to do if you don't pass the graduated income tax. We went through that exercise a couple years ago. It's very difficult. We actually passed some services, expansion of sales tax on some services out of the Senate, again, not the House. And the amount of money you raise is really not enough to make such a difference. So I think that what he's proposed is the most straightforward thing to do.
Senate President John Cullerton, thank you for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
That's Senate President John Cullerton. Lawmakers weren't the only ones closely listening to the governor's first budget address. So was organized labor. AFSCME Council 31 is Illinois' largest union of public employees, and it's an understatement to say they had a difficult relationship with our last governor, Bruce Rauner. On his first day in office, Governor Pritzker restored pay increases for the union's workers, increases that had been blocked by Governor Rauner even after a court order to pay them. John Cameron is Director of Community Relations with AFSCME Council 31. I started by asking what it was like to see the governor restore those raises.
Well, again, he indicated he will restore them. They actually have not come through yet. That'll probably be about the 1st of April when they actually see them in their paychecks. But for state employees who have been owed thousands of dollars for, several years now, this is very, very important. And it was certainly a good sign that this administration is serious about taking care of working people.
And how do you feel in terms of that step, in terms of contract negotiations between the government and AFSCME at this point?
Well, we're are delighted that he's indicated that he will sit down and begin serious negotiations with us. As you know, Governor Rauner walked away 3 years ago from the table and unilaterally ended bargaining. The court subsequently ruled that he was in error, and Governor Pritzker has made a clear indication that he wants to sit down and get to the hard business of collective bargaining, but important business. So.
The other hard business is our pension situation and how that will be resolved. I wonder if you agree with his approach that he outlined in his budget address today in terms of pensions?
Well, we certainly agree with his firm commitment to actually paying the benefits that are due both retired and working state employees, university employees, and teachers around the state. As to the specifics of how he wants to manage the paying off the pension debts, we have some concerns, but we look forward to sitting down and making sure that anything that is implemented is fiscally and actuarially sound.
What are your main concerns right now?
Well, in terms of?
The pension. You said you had some specific concerns.
Well, obviously it's a multi-state or multi-pronged approach to dealing with the pension debt. And We're interested in what the bond houses have to say and how they would look at it. There's some element of borrowing in it. There's some element of rescheduling payments so that they're stretched out. And we want to make sure that, you know, in the end, we have a package that will assure that the funding is there for benefits going forward and that, you know, does not incur additional costs to the state and the taxpayers in the future.
John, I wonder if you have, or AFSCME has, a specific policy position in regards to Governor Pritzker's progressive income tax. He talked a lot about this fair tax, as he's referring to it. This would require quite a bit of work in terms of having this implemented. We haven't seen details, but in principle, is this something that you all support?
Oh, wholeheartedly. We think it's extremely important for the future of the state. Our union has been the supporter of the fair tax structure since we've been around for over 40 years, worked on this issue many times in the past. It's very heartening to see not only the governor, but the vast majority of the lawmakers embrace the concept. We look forward to putting it on the ballot and convincing voters that it's the next important step we need to do.
How important do you think it will be, the role of AFSCME, in that vote, if it is to get on the ballot in a 2020 election year? How important do you think this will be an issue for you all to help mobilize people on?
Well, it'll be extremely important for us to do that, particularly, you know, like our employees in the University of Illinois system who are work for the higher ed system that's dependent on state money. They need it, as well as state employees who do the many other services the state government provides. AFSCME, you know, is a large statewide organization. We intend to put all of our muscle behind it as best we can, and that means convincing our members that it's a good idea and also getting them to convince their neighbors it's a good idea.
John Cameron is the Director of Community Relations with AFSCME Council 31. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, thank you very much.
Just a disclaimer for all of you listening. I am a state employee, along with the rest of our team at the 21st. AFSCME Council 31 is Illinois' largest union for public employees, but I, no one on our staff, are members of that or any union. Later on in the hour, we'll get reaction from Illinois Manufacturers Association and the Children's Home and Aid Society. But first, coming up after the break, Chris Capozzello is a photojournalist who's behind a film and photo exhibition that's about being the healthy twin of someone with cerebral palsy. Stay close. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I thought that I actually caused my brother to have cerebral palsy. It was a question that felt very real to me back then. And even as a young adult, I still felt that maybe I was trying to push my way free first in the womb. And I'm ashamed that I have all the abilities and all the strengths that he doesn't have.
That's the voice of photojournalist Chris Capozzello. Chris, his brother Nick, and their family are the subject of the film The Distance Between Us, which explores Nick's cerebral palsy. Chris is here in Urbana as a George A. Miller visiting artist at the University of Illinois. An opening reception for Chris's photos and this exhibition, if you're in Central Illinois, is at the University YMCA tonight at 5 o'clock. He's with us right now in our studios in Urbana. Chris, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Nyla.
So this film, and there's a book which has photographs that you have made of you and your brother, and photographs your brother has taken as well. Mm-hmm. It's really about your relationship. And you ask some really, really big questions in this book and in this film. I imagine those are questions you've been asking yourself your whole life.
When I was a kid, I asked myself, you know, why is this Nick? Why did it happen to him and not to me? And you know, these private questions that I didn't share with anybody. I thought, like, my parents knew this. And when the book was published, right before it went to press, I read them the entire thing and showed them the photographs that were going to be in it, which was a nerve-wracking thing because it couldn't be changed at that point. But they didn't know that I had feelings of guilt and anger and, you know, shame for being the healthy twin. And so it was surprising to me that they didn't realize that. But, you know, from a young age, when you grow up next to somebody that has a much different experience in life than, you know, than you do, then, it was heavy. It was very heavy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to carry. I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about Nick. And I think a lot of people have heard of cerebral palsy, but don't know exactly what it is. And then there's lots of different varying ranges and degrees of problems that people have when they have cerebral palsy.
Right. So CP is this umbrella term for a neuromuscular disorder. And it's, you know, there are people on campus, you know, in Dres, you know, that are in a wheelchair. And Nick is very different, has been very different than the people I've met here who have those experiences. For most of his life, he didn't have to use a wheelchair. He does now. And so he's been historically ambulatory. He can have a conversation with you. His cognitive abilities are different. So I sat in on we had a panel discussion 2 weeks ago, and there were students that also have twins. And so, you know, these disabled students who have this other experience, Nick is not like them in that way. Nick has these cognitive disabilities and physical disabilities that aren't as severe.
And you have been your career as a photojournalist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always, even before you were working as a professional journalist, were you taking pictures of your brother?
So I started making photographs of Nick when I was in college, and we had professors who pushed us and challenged us to photograph things that are around us every day. And that can be a challenging thing, because how do you see the things that are ordinary to you? How do you photograph those things? It's sometimes the experience of going into other people's lives that you're not familiar with, everything is new. And so that's a different experience. And so to photograph what is around you every day can be quite challenging. And so I was trying to find myself, you know, who am I as a photographer? And a professor that I'm very close with challenged me with that. And so when I went home on breaks, I'd have my camera with me. My camera's in the other room right now. And I started photographing my brother. And, you know, I likened it to just practicing. And as I got older, I continued to make pictures of Nick, not with any intention of sharing those pictures, but I just kept photographing him. But then I started photographing him when things were very difficult. So Nick's experience can change. There's like transformative where he will be walking around or hanging out, and then he starts to get a cramp, and so he won't be able to talk.
And they're debilitating. I mean, the amount of pain.
They are, yeah. And so his body kind of contorts and locks, like when you have a cramp in your leg, right? But he'll have this cramp for hours, and so he'll get a cramp in his arm, and it'll sort of like curl behind him, and his other arm might curl inward. Sometimes his back will arch with a cramp, and his foot will curl in. Sometimes his other leg will get a cramp. And so, you know, Nick would have to sleep that off. We'd get him in bed, and sometimes that would take just a couple of hours for that to go away. Sometimes it would be days where he'd be in bed. And so I was making photographs, you know, during the fun times, you know, when we're out, you know, at a bar and he's doing karaoke.
And dancing,
yes. There's that one photograph in the book where he's dancing with this woman. And we're in California visiting a friend, and he wanted to dance with somebody. And so my friend's sister asked this woman, "Would you dance with my friend?" And she, you know, this woman, Rachel, thought it was really strange. She said no, but as like probably 5 or so minutes later, she walked over and said, "Okay, I'll dance with you." And the funny thing about it is the text that goes along with it, right?
Right. When she says that, "Stop looking at my feet."
Yeah. And then and he tells me this, and later on he recounts, "I wasn't looking at her feet."
Right. We're not going to go into what he was looking at, right?
I didn't ask him. I didn't.
But
you got to let it be sometimes, you know.
How did your family react to you making photographs of the good and the hard times? Was it just kind of just part of life for you guys?
You know, I'd make these pictures and I wouldn't show it to anybody. I didn't show them to Nick. I didn't show it to my parents. So, you know.
Did you look at them?
I did. I looked at them. And, you know, I think in the very beginning, it actually wasn't a healthy thing. At this point, I would say that, you know, the photographs were a cathartic experience, but that didn't come until much later. In the very beginning, I would look at these photographs of my brother in pain, and you know, it was somewhat masochistic. I would look at these things, and it was like I was inviting more pain for myself. You know, I would be angry that it was him who has such a difficult time in life. And, you know, these feelings of anger and guilt, and the feelings of shame aren't shame. I'm not ashamed of my brother, but I'm ashamed of being that example of what life could have been like for him, because CP is this accident at birth in Nick's situation, and he was supposed to be just like me. He was born and he wasn't breathing, and that changed, you know, our lives forever, and Nick's more so than mine. So,
and when it's your twin, like you write about this in the book, how your teachers would say things like, "Oh, I couldn't tell you guys apart," which would infuriate you.
It still does, yeah. And you know, this there's this idea of, you know, when we talk about race, like, well, I don't see color, and I just think that that's for me, that's ridiculous.
When it comes to people, their disabilities or abilities.
Exactly. And so, I mean, in terms of race, if I say, well, I don't see color, then I think that I'm denying anybody who's not white like me. I'm denying any sort of difficulties they face because of their race. And when I look at my brother or anybody who has a disability, I think, well, they're different than me. And I'm okay with saying that. Some people aren't and find that quite offensive, but I think that if I look at my brother and think, well, he's just like me, then I deny him as well all these challenges that he faces in life. And I don't want to look at those challenges and dismiss them.
So was your family okay with you doing a film?
Right. So you asked that too, right? About, I mean, the film and the photographs were much different.
And you're a photographer,
yeah.
So you are just, I'm a journalist, so I've been around a lot of photographers. Photographers just always have a camera with them, and that's just part of their lives.
Yeah, and the difference between the camera, the still camera, and the video camera is that if we're spending time together and I bring the camera up to my eye and I make a picture, I put the camera down. And so this moment of capturing is rather quick. But if I'm taking video of you, I'm locked onto you. And then I'm also trying to visually build a scene. And so it's more comprehensive. And when I had met the folks at MediaStorm and decided we were going to do this, first I asked my family, are you up for this? This is the work that they do. And it's going to be different because it's not just going to be me with a camera. Other people are going to show up. They're going to be taking, you know, video. They're going to be gathering audio. There's going to be more
people. It's going to be invasive.
Extremely invasive. And so in the very beginning, they didn't quite understand what that was going to be like because they had no experience prior to that. And so up front, they were fine. And then as this dragged out, it became much more difficult for them. MediaStorm wanted to do an interview with my parents, and they pushed back on it quite a bit at that time. They didn't want to talk. And when you have that camera on you that is just continually rolling, you feel like you're under a microscope. If I make this one click, that's just a photograph. But when the camera is rolling and collecting video and audio, everything is there. And where a photograph is silent, and there's a beauty in that, there's also a danger in that. Because you can look at a photograph and
make assumptions about things.
Complete in you know, ridiculous assumptions, right? And based on your ideas of what you're looking at and your preconceived notions, with the video camera, somebody was looking and listening to everything they were doing. It wasn't just click one moment.
I wonder if we can play a little clip. This focuses, as you mentioned, there's a lot of conflict between your brother's desire for independence in the film, mm-hmm. and his need for support and safety. And this is actually you talking. I wonder if we can play a clip of that.
My brother is well enough to look at the world around him and understand what he's missing. He gets it. But he's not capable of understanding how to do things to get what he wants. He won't look at himself and see himself for who he really is. That is a failure on his part, but that comes from his experiences growing up. You can do anything, Nick. bull. Like, how can you do that to somebody?
That's a clip of our guest, Chris Capozzello, talking about his brother Nick in the film The Distance Between Us, and Chris is in studio with me. Chris, I think that captures a lot of the tension, right? Not just between you, like, I think you're kind of this, in some ways you're an observer of this because you're not living in your parents' house with him, but then, so you kind of, I think captures a lot of the complicated feelings around the relationship between you and your brother, between your brother and your parents. What was it like for your family, I wonder, when they saw all of this?
So there was a tremendous amount of tension surrounding Nick moving out. And I wasn't silent about my feelings about that. So they already knew how I felt. And I said, I will speak candidly when I'm interviewed by Media Storm.
Because at this point, your brother is, he's 30.
We were 35.
You were 35.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, my gripe was that he wasn't prepared to move out, that it wasn't safe for him to move out. I think it was worth taking a risk so that Nick could live a fuller life.
But you were real, I mean, you can see it in your face in the film, how worried you are.
Yeah. And I'm still worried about my brother. And he's making it. He's still on his own. But he's not safe. And when we talk about, when I mentioned before about cognitive issues, when you and I, the difference between you and I and my brother would be that when we go to cross the street and we're at a crosswalk, we have the right to walk, right? But we should look both ways and not walk in front of a car. A month and a half ago, Nick came to a crosswalk and just went. And he got hit by a car. But he thinks he can, and he was upset. He was angry at the person driving the car. And the person driving the car had no time to stop before they hit him. So those are the things that scare me. They still scare me. And I'm waiting for the call when, you know, I mean, the Milford Police Department called me because I was in emergency contact for him and said, your brother has been hit by a car. So, you know, there's tension, and the experiences that I have with my brother are far different than my parents. They have an adult child living with them for most, you know, their entire adult lives. And whether it's selfish or not, you know, they didn't want to give up their golden years. And part of it is that Nick is difficult. You know, when we look at people with disabilities, we often sentimentalize them, right? We think that, you know, I think we subconsciously think that sickness and disability beget virtue. Well, Nick is a human being just like you and me, and he's not always the nicest of people. And I don't know you. I think you're pretty great. We've met a couple of times, but I'm pretty sure you can be a jerk. Because you're a human
especially
being.
Especially to our siblings.
Yeah, you're a human being, I'm a human being, and we're connected in that way. And so the hard part is that, you know, I say without having the experience of my parents that's selfish for you to do that. And part of me, you know, thinks that it's selfish because he's also not been prepared. And that is that's the scariest thing. I think that. And he's making it now. So, you know, maybe I've been proven wrong in this whole scenario, but is he safe? And so I want Nick to be on his own. I want him, but I want him to be safe. And, you know, in his experience living on his own, he had me over for dinner and he was putting something in the oven and I watched him fall into the oven and I'm there and I'm watching it, but I'm too far away and I can't save him. And so he burns himself and he had burns all over his hands. And, you know, so on one hand, he's making it. On the other hand, he's also not completely safe.
That's photojournalist Chris Capozzello. He's here at the U of I as a George A. Miller visiting artist. And if you're interested in seeing Chris's photos, or if you're in the Urbana area and attending an opening reception for his exhibition, that will be going on at the University YMCA tonight at 5. The exhibition will be up through March. Chris, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, Governor Pritzker laid out his priorities not just for the state's budget, but for some of his bigger goals during his time in office, and one of them is a new income tax system. Right now, Illinois has a flat tax of 4.95%. The governor wants to change that to a progressive income tax, where higher-earning incomers pay more. In his speech, he called it a, quote, fair tax. Between that and the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour that will happen by 2025, the governor is set up for some hard conversations with members of the business community who oppose these measures. Mark Densler is president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I caught up with him yesterday from inside the Capitol building after the budget address, and I started by asking him about this very question of the so-called fair tax.
Most of the business community, including the manufacturers, are opposed to the graduated income tax. The flat tax is one of the benefits that we enjoy in the state of Illinois, and adding billions of dollars in new taxes on employers is not something that they see as advantageous to doing business in the state of Illinois.
And so when we're talking about individuals and perhaps lowering the tax rate for individuals at a middle class level, is that something that you think business owners would support?
Well, again, you have to look at the totality of it. And the only bill that the Democrats have introduced in terms of rates increased the income tax for everybody making $15,000 or more. So we certainly support tax reform and looking at the totality of the system, but simply adding increased income tax on a shrinking sector of the population doesn't seem to make sense.
The governor also mentioned a downstate revitalization program. I wonder if that's something that he's talked to you about as you have members throughout the state, if you have a sense of what he's trying to get at with that.
You know, we have not talked to the governor about that, but certainly rural areas of Illinois have really struggled to compete. We've seen people leave these communities, businesses close up, whereas Chicago, with the tourism and the excitement and the vibe, you've seen a lot of growth in downtown Chicago. But you're not seeing that similar growth in the outlying areas of Chicago and certainly in pockets of downstate Illinois.
So that brings me to something that happened before the budget address, which is the minimum wage, which the governor signed into law on Tuesday. This is something, obviously, the Illinois Manufacturers Association was disappointed in, did not like the process of how this went. In particular, what was the most disappointing thing to you about that process?
Well, the governor used kind of a closed-door process and actually didn't invite manufacturers to the table to talk about it, number one. But he didn't account for geographic regional cost differences, for example. The cost of doing business in Chicago or living in Chicago is far higher than it is in Springfield or Champaign or Carbondale. And so we understand something was going to happen. The manufacturers and the business community, we offered real reform that would have mitigated some of these costs, such as a geographic wage, a slower phase-in. So Chicago and Cook counties, you know, are already going to $13. They'll be there this year. At the end of the day, they will have had 10 years to phase it in, whereas downstate businesses and Collier County businesses are only going to have 5 years and one day to phase it in, including $2.75 within a year.
That said, it's done. So how are you going to help your members adapt to this?
Well, we've let them know what's happening. Unfortunately, the ramifications. I talked to a downstate manufacturer today who used to be exclusively in the state of Illinois. He's now in Arkansas and Missouri. He's got 4,000 total employees, 1,400 in Illinois. But again, all of his growth has been outside the state. And they told me again today that they're going to probably all their future investment will not be in the state of Illinois. So that's going to make it very difficult, again, for a downstate rural community. But businesses make decisions every day about where to invest their capital. And if Illinois is significantly less competitive, particularly downstate, businesses are going to look elsewhere.
And how much of that do you think is due to minimum wage versus other things in terms of the cost of doing business in Illinois, workers' compensation, things that you all have been working on for years? And I would say just the fact of having a stable business climate, which is something that a lot of employers say is important to them, as well as having stable investments in K-12 systems for their workers.
Well, you're right. And I'll start with the preface that Illinois should be the economic engine. When you look at where we're at, we have a central location, we have a great workforce, we do have a world-class city, a great infrastructure, colleges and universities. So we have everything it takes to be successful. But then you start looking, and for example, Illinois has only added 18,000 manufacturing jobs since the end of the recession. Our neighboring states have added an average of 68,000. So there are policy changes in Illinois that could make Illinois more attractive. And your point, they look at the totality of it, but they're looking right now at a minimum wage that's double what most of our neighboring states are. They're looking at potentially a graduated income tax. C corporations are already at 9.5%. They're looking at more wage and HR regulations and work comp. So they pile all these things on top, and not to mention the pension issues. They're looking at things down the road. We need stability and predictability more than anything, but they're looking at a lot of these things that are looming over their heads that could add cost to them.
Do you feel like we have a sense of things being more stable this year with this budget process, getting perhaps back to normal? And the fact that this has been a budget that has been presented, now we have the normal process of governing that's supposed to happen and to have a budget in place by May 31st. Do you think that will happen this year?
You know, I suspect we will have a budget in time this year, which is important. Going 2 years without a budget was unacceptable. We hope that the governor takes a different path than he did on minimum wage. We hope that he really talks to the business community, that he talks to the Republican Party. Both sides have good ideas. We're hopeful that there is a budget, but I would keep in mind this budget, as the governor admits, is $3.2 billion out of balance. So despite all of the promises in the campaign in the last couple months that he would present a balanced budget, this budget is not balanced. That's one of our concerns, that, you know, kicking the can down the road for seven more years on pensions and not truly addressing that, looking down the road at a graduated income tax, but this budget is not balanced.
What would you like to see in order to have it become a balanced budget?
Well, again, I think we need to look at comprehensive tax reform, first of all. There's a whole host of things that we can do on that. I think you also have to look at spending cuts, and you have to look at pensions, which are driving it. So we need the stability and predictability. The IMA and manufacturers are not just saying no, but we're saying let's look at tax reform, for example, on a broad-based approach, not just raising taxes on a shrinking sector of the population.
That's Mark Densler, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I spoke with him yesterday from the State House in Springfield. By the way, if you've been tuning in this entire hour and listening carefully, you might recall Senate President John Cullerton saying that the governor's budget is balanced, but then you just heard Mark Densler say it isn't. What we do know is that the state is starting with a $3.2 billion budget deficit. The governor's office says his budget fills $2.2 billion of that, and the remaining $1 billion they're estimating will come from economic growth, including from changes in the minimum wage increase, as well as other state funds. All this hour, we've been hearing lawmakers and interest groups reacting to Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget address yesterday, and we wanted to end with Children's Home and Aid. They work in 60 counties across Illinois. Last year, they helped about 40,000 children and families in Illinois. Nancy Ronquillo is its president and CEO, and she's on the line with us now. Nancy, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Nancy, I wonder what this time of year is like for you and how much attention you all are paying to the governor's budget address.
We pay attention to it with laser intensity. It is so important to the children and families we serve across Illinois to have the support and possibility to succeed. And the state's investment in our work and others who do this work is just critical to their futures.
And when you say it's critical, how much of what you do depends on stable funding from state government?
85% of what we do for kids and families across Illinois, it depends on the state of Illinois' funding and other public funds, such as the federal funding and local funding.
Nancy, I wanted to play
the lion's share.
A huge amount, right? I wanted to play a clip of Governor Pritzker's speech. Yesterday, he spoke about early childhood education, and he mentions the amount of money he'd like to allocate in his budget for that.
Investing in early childhood is the single most important education policy decision government can make. That's why I'm proposing funding the Early Childhood Block Grant at $594 million, an increase of $100 million from fiscal 2019. It will allow us to begin the march toward universal preschool so that every child in Illinois will have a real opportunity to succeed.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker yesterday in his budget address. Nancy, I wonder from your perspective with Children's Home and Aid, what do you think agencies would be able to do with that extra $100 million a year in block grant money?
What happens when there are additional dollars available for pre-K is that there are more children who are going to have that experience. And there are three decades of research that shows that the return on that investment will be profound in terms of academic success, lifetime earning, a reduction in the kinds of problems that kids have when they don't succeed in school and in community. And I'm talking about teen pregnancy and crime. So we agree with the governor that this is just one of the best investments that can be made in children, and we're excited to see more kids will have the chance to have that that learning and that developmental help.
Nancy, last month we spoke with you about your top priorities for the Pritzker administration. Do you feel like he started to address some of those priorities yesterday?
I do think that the governor came to Illinois with a real strong, clear vision about how to take us where we are now to where we all want to be, where every family and every community and every child in Illinois is thriving. I think he was very much the realist in terms of this doesn't happen overnight and there's no magic at work. It's going to take several years, but he's put some stakes in the ground about what matters a great deal and how to prime the pump for success. And when $100 million for the block grant in early childhood is a good example, the very preliminary and first investment in DCFS, having additional staff so that children who may be at risk of abuse or neglect can be responded to more quickly and more thoroughly. That's a very small step, but it is a step in a direction of a very important priority for Illinois and for Children's Home and Aid. And there are other things that the governor talked about that I think represent. He's got an honest and full-on kind of commitment to dealing with decades-long issues of injustice and inequity and really trying to think about making change in Illinois in a way that is holistic and coordinated and efficient and, you know, all of the things that we know, if we work harder and do some things together and differently, we can get more value out of the public sector's investment or the Illinois taxpayers' investment in great communities.
Nancy, we just have about a minute or so left, but I just want to ask you on that last point, how you think things should be done differently. Did you see something different yesterday that gives you hope? What would you like to see, not just from Governor Pritzker, but from lawmakers in Springfield when it comes to our most vulnerable children and families throughout the state?
I'm very positive and very excited about the tone that the governor set. That is, we are going to work for solutions together across the aisle and on behalf of all of Illinoisans. The wrangling and wrestling and struggle we've had that has depleted our ability to get real momentum. And so I'm really, really excited about the leadership and the willingness to take on the big problems in a practical way. I'm hopeful and very much will be advocating for early investment in the human services community capabilities, and I know that this budget does not reflect much in the way of those rate increases and reimbursement that's so pivotal to our being able to succeed in the work. And when those investments are made in child welfare, in positive youth development, in our veterans, in our seniors, when those investments are made, Illinois will thrive and have some huge progress.
Sounds like, of course, there's always a lot more work to be done, but I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us, share us a little bit about what Children's Home and Aid sees as its priorities for the coming budget year. Nancy Ronquillo is its president and CEO. Nancy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
That's all the time we have for this week. Over the past few days, we just wanted to end by updating you all. Residents of Aurora have been scheduling funeral services for the five people who were killed in a workplace shooting last Friday. Today, this afternoon, this evening, there will be a vigil at Northern Illinois University to honor two of their alums who died, Clayton Parks and Trevor Wehner. Senator Dick Durbin is also expected to attend. On Monday, we are going to be looking on the 21st at part of our state's law that allowed the gunman in Aurora to keep his firearm The Illinois State Police had revoked Gary Martin's permit, but didn't make sure that he gave up his gun. WBEZ's Patrick Smith has been looking into this. He joins us on Monday to share what lawmakers have in mind to fix this problem. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows and listen to your home NPR station. We're also available on iTunes, Android, most places where you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. If you follow us today, you've got lots of pictures of what it was like for us interviewing folks in the state capitol yesterday. Our Facebook page is another way to communicate with us. Search for the 21st to like us. And if you don't remember any of that, just remember our website, 21stShow.org. That's directions for how to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, as well as all of our handles. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.